All right, we are right in the middle of Jeremiah. Let's take our Bibles and turn there, please. The 27th chapter, if you will. In chapter 25, Jeremiah revealed what had been a great secret, and that was that when the captivity does come, it'll be 70 years long. Of course, chapter 25 is a commentary on the events that took place back in chapter 7. And so we connect those two chapters. Then in chapter 26, Jeremiah risks his life. He nearly died and would have died had he not been saved by a man named Ahikam. I did not comment very much on Ahikam. He's mentioned there in verse 24 of chapter 26. Very fascinating family. And I think I'll go into detail on that next week, because his brother's going to show up. Essentially, just to give you a sneak preview, Ahikam is one of four sons of Shaphan. Shaphan is the man that found the book of the law in the temple under King Josiah. And so he has four sons. One is a rogue scoundrel. The other three are pretty good guys. So we'll talk about those brothers when the other brother shows up in chapter 29. But right now we are in chapter 27. That's where we will begin. And let's just go ahead and read the first six verses of Jeremiah 27. In the beginning of the reign of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, came this word unto Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, Thus saith the Lord to me, Make thee bonds and yokes, and put them upon thy neck. So you understand what the command is here? That word yokes is plural, not because he wore two yokes, but the yoke had a front piece and it had a rear piece. When you actually would yoke the cows together, the animals, the cattle, they had a front, like a breast piece, and a rear for the back. And it was those two wooden parts were tethered together by leather straps. So that's why you have the plural yoke. So basically God says, I want you dressed up like an animal. All right? Verse 3. And send them to the king of Edom, the king of Moab, the king of Ammonites, the king of Tyrus, and to the king of Zidon, by the hand of the messengers which come to Jerusalem unto Zedekiah, king of Judah. So evidently, this vision begins in the days of Jehoiakim and then lingers all the way into the days of Zedekiah. But the message here is going to be to these delegates from these nations who will congregate in Jerusalem for a summit meeting with King Zedekiah, who you'll know will be the last king of Judah. Verse 4, And command them to say unto their masters, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Thus shall ye say unto your masters. So I got a message for you. You go and tell your kings this. I have made the earth, the man, and the beast that are upon the ground by my great power and by my outstretched arm, and have given it unto whom it seemed meet unto me. And now have I given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beasts of the field have I given also to serve him. All right, so before we get to the rest of the message, I want to point out that once again now, Jeremiah is being summoned to use one of these action sermons. The book of Jeremiah is full of these things. It's kind of like if I was to stand up here and actually act out what the message is. That's what Jeremiah is doing. It's done as an attention getter, all right, to the people. And he did it at a time when Zedekiah was conferring with these representatives from essentially what amounts to be the five neighboring nations of Israel. They were regretful, or strange bedfellows for sure, allies of Judah, and they're having this summit meeting together to plan a strategy to deal with what they are all fearing is the coming invasion of Nebuchadnezzar. All right. So what's Jeremiah going to say about this powwow between the king of Judah and these rogue nations? Well, Verses 1 through 22 are all about the message. And the message is going to be divided up into three different segments, which Jeremiah does a lot of times. He'll preach the same message to this group, then he'll preach it again to this group, and then he'll preach it again to this group. In all three messages, he warns them about false prophets. But there are other similarities too. All right, so let's look at each group. By the way, what do you think the message of the yoke is? What does a yoke symbolize? Jim?
Servitude.
Yes. Absolutely. Submission, right? Forced submission. And that's exactly the message that God gave to Jeremiah, trying to get across to these people. And so first of all now, Jeremiah sends this message to these envoys. You see the nations that are listed in verse 2, and they're going to be the first ones to get the word. And the message to them goes down through verse 11, okay? So this is just a bunch of politicians, all right, ambassadors, if you want to be a little kinder than that. And what they needed was not some clever strategy on how to defeat Nebuchadnezzar, all right? It was to obey God the first time. God had commanded earlier that they were to submit to Babylon. And so when Jeremiah is asked, what in the world is this getup? Why are you wearing this yoke? That's when he gives them, that's the trigger to preach the message to them from God. So the message is the same as it's been now. Judah and all of you other nations, all five of you, you all need to submit to Nebuchadnezzar. And if you don't do it, you will be destroyed. Okay, so God had given all of those nations over to Babylon. Babylon was the leader ruler of the world at that time. One of the first major world power. And any nation that rebelled against Babylon at this point now they did not. This would be the furthest thing from their mind. But to rebel against Babylon at this point is to rebel essentially against God. All right, notice verse 7. And all nations shall serve him and his son. The him is Nebuchadnezzar. And his son's son until the very time of his land come. And then many nations and great kings shall serve themselves of him. In other words, you're going to serve him, but then he's going down because of what he's done. Verse 8, and it shall come to pass that the nation and kingdom which will not serve the same Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and that will not put their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation will I punish, saith the Lord, with the sword and with the famine and with the pestilence. There's those three that we've seen over and over again so far. The sword, the famine, and pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand. And you got the same thing in verse 11. Right, but the nations that bring their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon and serve him, they're going to have a different fate. Those will I let remain still in their own land, saith the Lord, and they shall till it and dwell therein. In other words, it'll be like nothing even happened. You'll be able to continue your life if you submit to Nebuchadnezzar. If you don't, you're going to die. All right, so he sent this message to these envoys that are gathered with King Zedekiah in Jerusalem. They had certainly had heard about this very peculiar guy, Jeremiah, that was walking around wearing a yoke. What's up with this guy wearing an animal yoke? Okay, and so verse 10, for they prophesy, Jeremiah says, for they prophesy a lie unto you to remove you far from your land, that I should drive you out and ye should perish. Okay? So the yoke was the picture what God had intended to happen. Notice where it says there that all nations shall serve him, that's the Nebuchadnezzar, and his son's son. Now that's more of a... That's kind of like that God will visit the sins of the father to the third and fourth generation. That means that that God's going to be consistent no matter what. It's more of a proverbial expression than anything else. It just means you're going to serve him a long time, enough for more than one generation. And we know it has to mean that because Nebuchadnezzar's son was a man named Evil-Merodach, And he did succeed him. In fact, we'll read about him in chapter 52, evil Merodach. But then he was followed by his brother-in-law, not Nebuchadnezzar's other son. The brother-in-law of evil Merodach was a guy named Nergal-Sharezer. And we read about him in Jeremiah 39. All right, he was not Nebuchadnezzar's son. So it's not that there's errors in the text. It's just that we have to be able to recognize proverbial expressions. And that's what this is. Okay, so the grandson is not even in view here. Now, the whole region is being dominated by falsities. That's the major problem of this time. Judah, what do they have? False prophets. False prophets, false as the day is long. But the Gentiles, they got all kinds of stuff. They have diviners. The diviners are people that read omens. In fact, if you go to a place like Greek and look at the ancient sites in Greece, you'll see all kinds of evidences of this on the tours that they take you on. They have dreamers, people who interpret dreams. Dreams were a big deal in the pagan realm in which Jeremiah lived. They had enchanters or sorcerers, who were people that actually, they made no bones about it. They claimed to collaborate with demons in order to discover or to control the future, you see. It was underworld, darkness. But neither Judah nor the Gentile nations, they dared to listen to these purveyors of lies. They shouldn't have done it. Because dabbling in the occult, absolutely, totally forbidden by the Mosaic Law. Leviticus 19 and verse 26, you shall not eat anything with the blood, neither shall ye use enchantment nor observe times. So it was expressly forbidden. And then in the Deuteronomy 18, when Moses preaches exactly the same thing to the second generation, you have the reinforcement of that prohibition. So why would Zedekiah even think about listening to political counsel from these pagans that comes from the pit of hell? Friends, this is the reason. It's illustrations like this that God gives us. Why we have New Testament passages like 2 Corinthians 6, verses 14 through 18. Come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and I will receive you. All right, that's not something new. That's not something for only this dispensation. This was always God's will. Okay, so Jeremiah gives this message to these ambassadors who he assumes will take it back to their respective kings. All right, now, in verses 12 through 15, you have Jeremiah giving the same message to a private audience, which would be King Zedekiah. Okay? So let's see that. I spake also to Zedekiah, king of Judah, according to all these words, saying, bring your necks under the yoke of the king of Babylon, and serve him and his people, and live. Why will ye die, thou and thy people, by the sword, by the famine, by the pestilence, as the Lord hath spoken against the nation that will not serve the king of Babylon? Therefore hearken not unto the words of the prophets that speak unto you, saying, ye shall not serve the king of Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you. That's what the false prophets were saying. Nebuchadnezzar is not going to have anything on us, right? Verse 15, for I have not sent them, saith the Lord. I didn't send these false prophets. And yet they prophesy a lie in my name. They're using that prescription, thus saith the Lord. But really what they're saying is, thus saith the devil. Okay? That I might drive you out and that you might perish, ye and the prophets that prophesy unto you. Okay? So what's Zedekiah's stance? What is his position? His position had been now for years to rebel against Babylon. All right, he refuses to pay their tribute. He won't do it. And so now he is in serious trouble. And he's hanging on a thread in the hopes that the false prophets are right. Okay? So when the king finally sees Jeremiah coming and wearing this yoke on him, right? I mean, he's getting the message. He's absolutely getting the message. Bring your necks under the yoke of the king of Babylon and serve him and his people and live, verse 12. That's how you're going to survive. Do what I'm telling you. So Jeremiah, he warns the king, don't listen to the deceptive messages of these fake prophets. They're speaking lies and doing it in the name of Jesus Christ. Okay, then a third message now in verses 16 through 22. And he delivers the message to the priests of Israel, the religious leaders, and the people, priests and people, in 16 through 22. All right, let's look at 16. Also, I spake to the priests and to all this people, saying, thus saith the Lord, hearken not to the words of your prophets that prophesy unto you, saying, behold, the vessels of the Lord's house shall now shortly be brought again from Babylon, for they prophesy a lie unto you. Hearken not unto them. Serve the king of Babylon and live. Wherefore should this city be laid waste? And that's definitely what was going to happen. So what's going on here? You've got all kinds of false prophets. They're like a club. Right, there's like a house of them, and they're spread out all over Israel, and they're claiming that all those valuable articles of gold and of bronze that the Babylonians had taken out of the temple in the first raid. Remember our years for the Babylonian raids? The first raid was 605 B.C. Besides hauling off Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're hauling off all the gold and jewels out of the temple. Okay? The false prophets are saying, thus saith the Lord, in a very short time, all of the temple gold and jewelry is going to be returned to Jerusalem. And Jeremiah is listening to this, and he knows that it's a lie. He knows it's a lie. Actually, we actually know when they were brought back, that those treasures were not brought back until God visited the Jews and the remnant returned to Judah after the decree of Cyrus. So all that furniture and the stuff that was in the temple, it doesn't get back till Ezra chapter 1, right? And that wasn't what was important. I mean, even if they didn't get it back, it was easily replaceable, okay? The important thing was to rescue the temple and to save the people from death and the city from complete annihilation. And that could be done only if the nation agreed to submit to Nebuchadnezzar. So what Jeremiah does is he actually taunts the false prophets. He says, well, I think you all ought to pray about this. It's actually funny. You know, there is a sense of humor in the Bible, really, especially in this chapter. It's really, I think, very fascinating. Jeremiah says, I think you ought to pray about this, about to your gods, you know. I mean, to the Lord, because they're claiming to speak on behalf of Jehovah. I mean, after all, if they had been true prophets of God, then the Lord will surely answer their prayers because they would have been God's men. And so he tells Jeremiah, he says, you better start praying, but not for the return of the treasures now, okay, that are in Babylon. Pray for the preservation of the treasures still in the temple, because they didn't get them all. There was still some left. All right, so pray for what's left over. Verse 17, hearken not unto them. Serve the king of Babylon and live. Wherefore should this city be laid waste? Verse 18, but if they be prophets, and if the word of the Lord be with them, let them now make intercession to the Lord of hosts, that the vessels which are left in the house of the Lord and in the house of the king of Judah and at Jerusalem go not to Babylon. Okay? Pray that God doesn't let all the rest of the furniture go. So when the Babylonians organized their second deportation, that would be in 597 BC, right at the beginning of Zedekiah's reign, it proved that the false prophets were indeed liars, All right, and that their prayers are not going to be answered. Okay, so and there's going to be a third deportation in 586. In all three of these deportations, the Babylonians are holding off all the gold they can carry out of that temple. So Jeremiah ends his message to the priests and the people with a promise of hope. And that is that at the end of the 70 years of captivity, God's going to visit his people in Babylon, and he's going to bring them back into the land. And it's going to be just like what the other minor prophets had talked about, Amos, Habakkuk, like Habakkuk 3:2, in wrath, remember mercy. And Jeremiah is prophesying God is going to do that. You are going to get back in the land. But of course, it'll be too late to avoid what could have been avoided. All right, that brings us to chapter 28. Chapter 28 is just a natural continuation of the events of chapter 27. And what you're going to have in the first 17 verses of chapter 28 is the yoke that Jeremiah is wearing around him, which had to be uncomfortable. Can you imagine what it would be like? I mean, that thing was heavy, you know? And so it's going to get ripped off him. So let's see what happens. Let's just go ahead and read it in verse 1. It says, "And it came to pass the same year, in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the fourth year and in the fifth month, that Hananiah," now this is public enemy number one. Hananiah is an unbelievably bad guy. The son of Azur, the prophet, which was of Gibeon. Gibeon actually was one of the cities that Joshua designated back in the book of Joshua to be a Levitical city. Gibeon was a house of that was supposed to hold nothing but but Levites, because the Levites had no land allotment. And so it's very likely that this Hananiah came from a priestly family, a legitimate priestly family, even though he turns into a lackey of the devil. Okay? So verse 2, here's what you should say. Here's what's being said. "Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, saying, I have broken the yoke of the king of Babylon." False message. Verse 3, "Within 2 full years will I bring again into this place all the vessels of the Lord's house that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took away from this place and carried them to Babylon." So instead of being conquered again in the invasion in 597, instead of that, 2 years from the date of this message, everything's coming back. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, all those captives, all that jewels, all that gold, it's all coming back. 2 years. That's kind of convenient, right? That's over 700 days he's got to be wrong. Well, verse 4, "And I'll bring again to this place Jeconiah," right? The king that was hauled off. That's the one, "render this man childless. King Coniah is also his name, or Jehoiakim is the three names he went by. He's coming back, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, with all the captives of Judah that went into Babylon, saith the Lord, for I will break the yoke of the king of Babylon. Verse 5, "Then the prophet Jeremiah said unto the prophet Hananiah," now this is a face-to-face, the good guy versus the bad guy. You talk about a showdown here, all right? "In the presence of the priests and in the presence of all the people that stood in the house of the Lord, even the prophet Jeremiah said," now we're shocked by this response. Hananiah has just preached a false message, and what does Jeremiah do? Verse 6, "Amen, the Lord do so. The Lord perform thy words, which thou hast prophesied, to bring again the vessels of the Lord's house and all that's carried away captive from Babylon into this place." Kind of shocked by that response, huh? "Nevertheless," verse 7, "hear thou now this word that I speak in thine ears and in the ears of all the people. The prophets that have been before me and before thee of old prophesied both against many countries and against great kingdoms of war and of evil and of pestilence. The prophet which prophesieth of peace, when the word of the prophet shall come to pass, then shall the prophet be known that the Lord hath truly sent him." In other words, if peace comes and you see Jeconiah coming about up over the hill, you'll know that Hananiah is correct. Right? Okay, so quite a passage here. While Jeremiah is wearing this yoke, right? Everybody can see it. Calling on the nation, the king, the people, the priests, to submit to Babylon, upraises Satan in the form of this guy Hananiah, the leader of the false prophets. And he physically confronts Jeremiah in the temple. You know, about this time, according to the secular historians, and it's true history, Nebuchadnezzar was putting down a revolt in his own land. And so Hananiah absolutely falsely interprets the uprising that's going on back there in Babylon as the end of Nebuchadnezzar's rule. In other words, Hananiah is prophesying Nebuchadnezzar is being defeated down in Babylon. And nothing could have been further from the truth. Because there's no CNN and NBC to report this. Okay, nobody knows really what's going on. So Hananiah, the evil one, announces that God had broken the yoke of the king of Babylon and that the temple treasures are going to be returned to Jerusalem within these 2 years. And then more than that, Jeconiah and all these exiles and all that gold's coming back. 700 days. Well, that completely contradicted everything that Jeremiah had truly spoken in the name of the real God. The Lord had told Jeremiah that those deported people, all those temple vessels that went out in 605, they're not going to be restored to the land until he visits the exiles, okay, at the end of their 70-year captivity. In fact, he told them that right at the end of chapter 27. Furthermore, Jeconiah, he's never going to return to Judah. He's going to die in Babylon, and sure enough, when you get to chapter 52, you read about his death. In fact, his death was already predicted in chapter 22, actually. All right, so how is Jeremiah? Hananiah is in Jeremiah's face. What's Jeremiah going to do? How is he going to respond to the message? And we're shocked at the response. We cannot believe our eyes in verse 6. He says, "Amen. So be it. May the Lord fulfill everything that you've promised." All right, now this is why hermeneutics is so important. How do you interpret that reply? Is Jeremiah a turncoat? Is he now on the side of the false prophets? Is he in agreement with what these false prophets were preaching? I mean, he absolutely knew better. Is that what's going on? Now, friends, we know. Jim, go ahead. Yeah, exactly. He's being.
And it doesn't come true that he's a false prophet.
Exactly. Or it's kind of like, oh, that the Lord had actually said the falsities that you're pronouncing. See, that's the way to understand it. That would actually make me very happy if that was true. But it's not. Jeremiah knew the whole time that Hananiah's prophecy of peace could never be fulfilled. By the way, when you get to the New Testament in like 1 Thessalonians 5, and you have the prophecy of the Apostle Paul, that when you hear them saying peace and safety, then sudden destruction, that's nothing new. All right, here it is. This had been going on the whole time in Israel's history. Okay, so if the false message had actually come true, and you see Jeconiah coming back and all that, it would totally have contradicted everything that not just Jeremiah was preaching. There were other prophets besides Jeremiah. Okay? In fact, last week we saw one of them got killed by Zedekiah. Okay? So if it were fulfilled, that would contradict everything that had been predicted that from everybody that had preceded them. Because they were prophesying judgment. Jeremiah's message was a message of judgment. So Hananiah, now I have found this true in my own life in dealing with false preachers. It's amazing how when you go out on a calling day, you meet them on the sidewalks. It's unbelievable. I wouldn't have time tonight to go into some war stories, but what happens every time is they get violent. When you start speaking truth to them, they get violent, especially the Jehovah's Witness. I found them to be the most violent. And they get really angry. So what Hananiah does is he grabs this yoke and physically yanks. He had to be strong to do this because this thing was tethered together. He rips the thing off of Jeremiah's neck and just throws it on the ground. And he breaks it right before all the people. There's a big crowd watching this. All right? In other words, if Jeremiah can preach action sermons, so can Hananiah. I've got an action sermon for you too. All right? Thus saith the Lord, he announced. Even so, verse 11, will I break the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, from the neck of all nations within the space of 2 full years. Totally false message. Now, not only would Judah be set free, okay, but also all the nations would remove the yoke of Babylon. Everybody's going to be, happy days are here again. That was the message of the false prophets. All right, so that contradicting message Jeremiah had preached to all the nations, that's not going to sit well with the people. I mean, if you're a carnal person and you're lost, what message is going to make you feel good? Jeremiah's message or the false message of the false preachers, of Reverend Wonderful? It's a no-brainer. Now, the amazing thing about the thing that amazes me is the restraint that Jeremiah uses here. I find it unbelievable, admirable and unbelievable at the same time. Because he doesn't resist Hananiah. I mean, I think about what would I have done if this guy grabs me, literally puts his hands on me and starts removing the thing that God put on me. I would have fought him tooth and nail. I guarantee you I would have. Jeremiah doesn't do anything. He doesn't reply. He doesn't protest. He doesn't try to fight him off. Look at verse 11, chapter 28, verse 11. At the very end, it says the prophet Jeremiah just went his way, just walked away. I've given you God's word. He just walks away. And so there's all the Levitical priests are standing. All the people are watching this, right, this dramatic scene. And they're probably interpreting what Jeremiah does as a defeat. Or he's changed. He's turned tail. He's now in agreement with the real men of God, like Hananiah. You see. But Jeremiah is just waiting. He's learned to be obedient. He's just waiting for the right message from the Lord that he can deliver at just the right time. And so the message to Hananiah, it's not only national, all right, symbolized by all the multitude that's listening, but it's also personal. Okay, as far as the nation was concerned, because they're going to follow this deceptive counsel, an iron yoke is going to be placed on their necks. And not a wooden yoke, an iron yoke. And that had been prophesied. We don't have time tonight because we're almost out of time. But look back at Deuteronomy 28:48, and you'll see that Moses had predicted that very thing for disobedience and failure to deal with false prophets. The nations would never escape. Nebuchadnezzar is going to be their master. He will enslave them. And friends, it's always the case. When you reject the very light yoke of God's will, you end up inevitably wearing the much heavier yoke that you made of your own making. It's what happens all the time. It happens in countless lives. I've been in the ministry for over 30 years, and I've seen this for 30 years. But trust me, I have. The personal message was that the false prophet is going to die before the year is up. Remember, Hananiah says 2 years, and you'll see King Jeconiah come back over the hill. Well, Hananiah is dead within 2 months. 2 months, Hananiah is dead. Look at verse 17. So Hananiah the prophet died the same year in the seventh month.
Wow.
2 years? How about 2 months, Hananiah? And you're gone. And you're in hell. Now, the people are so calloused, and this is what sin does to you. So sick with sin. You know what a callous is? You can't feel anything. You know, you just can't. You can stick a pin in you. You can't even feel it. They're so callous. This striking event. The prophet that they were hanging all their hopes on is dead. And they knew that he said 2 years. That still doesn't wake them up. They're all the more bent on doing evil. How sick is that? How nuts is that? Isn't that the way it works today too? We know better. We got the word of God. We know this is where this is going to lead. And we do it anyway. It's because human nature doesn't change. The leopard doesn't change his stripes or his spots. So God strikes this man dead in 2 months. And that's normally not what happens in the Bible, right? That's normally, we don't have that kind of amazing drama. Although it's not unknown, because in the book of Leviticus, here's the sons of Eli, and they're offering strange fire, and God says, bam! And they both drop dead immediately. Nadab and Abihu, dead. You know who else died? The sons of Korah in the book of Numbers. They want to lead a coup against Moses. God opens up the earth and swallows them down into hell alive. That's dramatic. You know who else died? King Uzzah. Uzzah, the Kohathite, the Levitical priest. He's walking the Ark of the Covenant along. The animal stumbles. The Ark, it looks like it's going to fall on the ground. Uzzah reaches out to hold the Ark up, and God strikes him dead instantly. See, what happened there? He was just trying to save the ark. He was taught from a child that you don't touch that ark. From a child he was taught that. And he knew better. That was just arrogance. And God struck him dead. See, the dirt wasn't sin, but the wicked hand of Uzzah, after he knew and taught from a 3-year-old that you don't do that, God struck Uzzah dead. You know who else got annihilated immediately? The entire Assyrian army by the angel of the Lord. Immediately. And then what about Ananias and Sapphira? Dead. So this is why it's so valuable to know your Old Testament, you know, because you come... You're with us in our morning series in the book of Hebrews, and we're going to eventually get to chapter 10 and verse 31, and it says, "It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God," and it's not like there's no precedent for that. There's plenty of precedent. All right.